So my name is Janine, and I've been having the pleasure of getting to teach for the last 3 years now. This is probably like my 3rd year anniversary right now, so that's delightful. And I'm also a teacher at NAU in sociology. I teach environmental sociology primarily, but also contemplative studies. I have some classes that mix sociology with these practices and other contemplative practices. I also do research in the environment and write on contemplative practices, Buddhism, and its connection with sociology. So there's a range. And I have 3 children. Many of you are aware of that. I talk about them here and there. A 20-year-old in college, and a 10-year-old, and a 6-year-old. So I keep pretty busy. But this is one of the great joys of my life, actually, getting to come and be with you and share the Dharma. I was just writing a list of 10 of my greatest joys, and it was interesting to see what arose. And one of the 10 greatest joys was preparing for Dharma talks. And then another one of them was delivering them. So that was pretty cool. Yeah. So I'm going to continue with a series that Brian has begun and that other of the teachers here will be also participating in, on the Four Noble Truths. And I understand that Brian has taught about the first three, and so I'm going to begin the fourth. But just to review, for those of you who were here and who haven't been here for those talks, the Four Noble Truths. The first one, there is suffering. And it's really critical. This is the first step on the path to realize that there is suffering. And then the second noble truth is that there are causes to the suffering. And at the very root of our suffering is ignorance. And then the third noble truth, because we know that there are causes, there's also the potential to cease suffering. So ceasing of suffering, freedom is possible. And then the fourth noble truth is the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And so tonight I'm going to offer a talk on the first factor of this Noble Eightfold Path, right view, or some might want to hear the Pali word, which is some of the language that the Buddhism was originally written with, and that is samadhi. So we'll talk about right view, samadhi. But I first want to talk a little bit about the interpenetration of the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. So there can be a tendency sometimes to think that these go in some particular order. Like we start with the first noble truth, we go to the second, and that there's some sort of linear progression here. But as we study the Dharma, we start to see that these, all of the noble truths and all of the eightfold paths are all they interpenetrate each other. And so sometimes we use metaphors to try to understand how these pieces come together. And we recognize that these are not stair steps. Like we can do the checkoff marks. Like now that I know that there is suffering, I've made it up the first step of the path. It's not really quite like that. And it's not even like, we might think of a spiral staircase. Okay, so they intermingle. So I'm going up some sort of spiral staircase. But I don't know that that's a very effective metaphor, too. So the metaphor that helps me understand the interpenetration of all of these pieces is the metaphor of a hologram. So if you think about a hologram, and you cut up a holographic photo into 100 pieces, say, each piece of the hologram reflects the whole. And so each part each factor in the Noble Eightfold Path and each of the Four Noble Truths, they're like pieces of the hologram, and each one reflects all the others. So they all co-arise together, and as we understand parts of one part, we begin to understand all parts. So today we'll explore this first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right view. We call it the first factor a little bit randomly, because as I said, it's not like we're going in some sort of linear progression, but it is helpful to consider a little order amongst the path, that some order helps our minds begin to understand. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a very well-acclaimed monk and intellectual and amazing being, he has written, "The first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Thus the two principles penetrate and include one another. The formula of the Four Noble Truths containing the Eightfold Path, and the Noble Eightfold Path containing the Four Noble Truths." So you can hear that these are all within each other. And there's another thing to consider as we're considering this first factor, right view. So we need both a view, or another way of saying view is understanding. So we're looking for understanding, and at the same time, we're exploring practice. So it's very interesting that this factor, right understanding, is within the Noble Eightfold Path, which is primarily focuses on practice. What can we do to achieve freedom? So the practice is often given primacy, like this brings the teaching to life. We have a lived experience, and the Noble Eightfold Path is going to help us with our practice. You might think of it as an embodied understanding, and this makes the liberation from suffering possible. Like, we need the practice here, and we don't get liberated through our mind's understanding alone. And so for the first 10 years of my practice was really dominated by an intrigue with the intellectual understanding of Buddhism and doing a lot of reading. And I was just very, very drawn in. And I often thought like I was getting liberated just from reading this material. Like if I just absorbed myself enough in it, I would gain this deeper understanding and I'd be free from suffering and I'd become an enlightened being, right? So we can get lost in the intellectualization of these teachings. And I've spoken with many people who are very attached to reading and they just love it. And I've found myself there often in my life. But recognizing that our suffering comes also from attachment. And so we need something beyond just the intellectualization. But the practice alone might not get us too far either. So sometimes we feel like, well, we just need to be a practitioner. If I stay here with this moment as it unfolds, I don't need all of that intellectual stuff. I don't need a Dharma talk. I can just become liberated. And that's true. We're all capable of liberation right here, right now, always. And I spent many years just so focused on the practice. I was trying to perfect my breathing and my perfect attention of the moment here and now. I remember even once with this Sangha announcing, I had a perfect sit. I was with my breath, every single breath, for 40 minutes. And I thought like that was something. And maybe it was. It's good to get focused attention. But I basically, you know, I feel like a bad meditator every time I strayed. And some of you may have had that experience where you just feel like, you know, I spent a whole sit, not even with one breath. I'm a bad meditator. So that's a misunderstanding, too, of the practice, that we need both the practice and focusing our attention, as well as the mindfulness practice piece, where we have expansive awareness. We need all of this, but we also need this, like, right understanding. So to apply the path, it's said that it needs to be properly understood. Not that there's one right way, but a depth of understanding. Bhikkhu Bodhi again says, in fact, right understanding of the path is itself a part of the practice. You can hear it again, this interpenetration, the Eightfold Noble Path being the practice, the way to the cessation of suffering, and this first factor being right understanding, a depth of reflection and learning. So we should be careful not to dismiss right understanding as overly intellectual and therefore unnecessary for the practice. Now, before I get into this factor, I also want to go over, because we're just beginning the Noble Eightfold Path, just to give you a little bit of a map of the territory. So the Noble Eightfold Path is composed of three groups: the morality group, the concentration group, and the wisdom group. So for the next two sits, this one and next Monday, I'll be offering Dharma talks on each of the wisdom group. So within the wisdom group, we have right, or what I'm going to be talking about as wise view or wise understanding today. And then next Monday, we'll talk about right or wise intention. But there's also the morality group, and some will be speaking about right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then there's the concentration group, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that's just to give you a whole, the big picture, some chapter titles thrown out there. So just to clarify, by right, we're not talking about there's only one way of thinking about seeing clearly without confusion, or there's only one way of understanding. So some teachers use the term wise, and I'll be emphasizing that language. And they use the term wise in place of right, so as to not confuse people with the idea that, you know, there's only one way and it's my way, or that I have the right answers. But really also being careful to recognize doesn't also mean that I have the wise answers either. The wisdom, the language of the wisdom, is pointing to kind of these deeper truths that arise through our own practice and through the depth of study and reflection. And a wisdom arises. It's not owned, and it's not just one way. So keeping that in mind. So order, again, it ultimately doesn't matter what order we go in, but it's helpful to start with wise view or samadhi. So beginning with wise view, it's like looking over a roadmap as you prepare to travel somewhere. So without a sense of where you're going and this big picture, it's easy to get lost and confused. So we can think about our views as our entire way of being in the world, that our views shape our reality, and they shape, we'll be talking about how they shape our attitudes, our ideas, our beliefs, and ultimately our actions. They color our views color our perceptions, our values, our ideas, beliefs, and the way that we make meaning in the world. So as I'm a sociologist, we also have a term for this, It's called The Social Construction of Reality. And I really think that it could benefit, our theories on social construction of reality could really benefit from this Buddhist perspective that's been around for 2,600 years, helping us to see how we create a sense of what we believe is real and how we act on that. So your views and your beliefs, the ideas that you hold true, they influence your values, what's important to you, which influences your attitudes, how you treat others and approach situations. And that influences your behavior, how you act. And so our views ultimately are like the foundation, the base for our action in the world. The great psychologist William James said, "The greatest discovery of my generation is that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind." Now, he's right in tune with Buddhism there. But it's interesting, I think, just noting the hubris, "the greatest discovery of my generation," which was, you know, he was saying that, I don't know, about 100 years ago. And keeping in mind that Buddhism has been around for 2,600 years. So sometimes modern Westerners take credit for that which has been realized before their time. And we can give some credit to Buddhism, I think, for some of these. So I want to give some examples of this thread, of this influence of view upon our attitudes, our beliefs, our ideas, and ultimately our behavior. So say you believe you're a bad person. You might start to develop a bad attitude. I've known people who think they're bad people, and they develop a pretty bad attitude, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And you start to see that their reactions to the world start reinforcing their attitudes and harmful behaviors. So people can get into this like negative feedback loop based on a belief, a fundamental belief about who they think they are. Or a more positive example, you believe that you're a helpful person, and so you value helpfulness. And you have this attitude of helping others, which receives positive reinforcement, and you start behaving more altruistically. So like in high school, I believed that it was important to be a helpful person. That got reinforced by my family. I started volunteering at a nursing home. That got more positive reinforcement and started to kind of become like a positive feedback loop. So research confirms this. In one study, children who were told that they were helpful people for doing something generous, like donating their marbles to poor children, later engaged in more altruistic behavior than did children whose behavior alone was praised or who did not receive praise. So I'll just offer a few more examples, personal examples, like believing a thought. This could be a view, thought of a view. You know, we often talk about in these circles that, you know, question our thoughts. And we might say, you know, are these thoughts true? Or are they just thoughts? So a recent example is, I had, and this is a minor example, but I had a view that my daughter, the oldest one, kind of would, when she would come home, she never really asked to use my stuff. She'd just use it, and then things would disappear. So I've gotten into the habit of when she's around and I can't find something, I believe she took it and that she was acting selfishly. And then I start acting on this behavior, you know, like building up this like blame and anger, getting into the cycle of like frustration and like, oh, the disrespect, and the whole narrative begins. And I was just about this last visit to act on it and call her on her, you know, what I thought was her little, you know, trick trickery again and tell her that that was unacceptable when I thankfully, before I acted, discovered that I had misplaced my mascara and it was my own, I misplaced the mascara. It was my own thing. So just seeing how our fundamental views, our beliefs, our values, we know that these impact our actions in the world. And even like right before I came here tonight, my kids built a fort in the forest, which I thought was really sweet. But they've been just, mom, you gotta come out to the forest and see the fort. And I had a really busy day today and I knew I was coming here. And in my mind, I had this idea like, all right, I'll just go see their fort. It's gonna be a bunch of sticks up on a tree, but I'm gonna go see their fort. So I go out with my son and I got to the fort and it was a magical experience. It was like these little, I don't know, it was like this place where I felt like they, like this beauty and they created rooms and it felt very magical. There was pine needles that were like on top of it and it was very like fluid and they put rocks on the floor and they made rooms and they decorated it with leaves and it was just like this really magical, sweet experience and totally like transformed my view when I was open to something else that was possible. But we can see like I had this like a little, you know, these judgments. And how our judgments can really impact our behavior. So to cultivate wise view, we begin by becoming aware of our underlying views, or at least catching them when they arise. Obviously I have not perfected wise view because I continue to have my, you know, have these beliefs that we kind of put substance into, rather than seeing the way that they're constructed right away. We'll kind of put some substance in it and then think that this is true. So we begin understanding becoming aware of our underlying views, our beliefs, our values, and our attitudes that guide our decisions and our judgments and our actions. Just becoming like aware of these. But what kind of underlying beliefs, values, and attitudes are we really interested in here in Buddhism? I mean, I think it's everything, right? But are we investigating beliefs about how good or bad a person we are, or beliefs around how helpful we are, as in the examples, some of the earlier examples I gave? Or are we investigating something deeper? And you might be able to see that was a leading question. You can see that where I'm going with this, that we're investigating something deeper than good versus bad or kind versus unkind. And in Buddhism, we're investigating our underlying assumptions about who we think we are, as in what is the self, as well as our assumptions about life and reality itself. But that's just a beginning. So the Buddha also describes wise view as a conceptual understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So he says, so it's said that he says, what now is right view? It is understanding of suffering, dukkha, understanding of the origin of suffering, understanding of the sensation of suffering, understanding of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. He also says we're invited to see that the world is a bondage to attachments, clingings, and biases. And it is through these attachments, clingings, and biases that suffering arises. So we're called to investigate not only our assumptions about self and reality, but our attachments, clingings, and biases, and seeing deeply into how these all lead to suffering. And still, in one way of saying it, we're only at the beginning of the path. Right view becomes a transformation in perception that arises from living the Dharma. So here you can feel the practice coming back in. It's not just by studying, reflecting, listening to a Dharma talk about it, but it also comes from living the Dharma. So right view arises in two stages. We can think of it this way. One is that right view that accords with the Four Noble Truths. In other words, we understand these truths through learning, studying, and reflecting upon them. And then the second way we can think of it is the right view that penetrates these truths. This is the experiential perception of these truths, or as the language I used earlier, is an embodied understanding. And for this, we turn to the practice of meditation. So through sustained concentration and mindfulness practice, insight arises. But it's not insight into, like, what do I do with this problem, right? It's the insight into the nature of reality, including suffering and how to alleviate suffering. And the Buddha even tells us what these insights into reality look like. So he gives us the roadmap, but he invites us to find out for ourselves what these really mean. So he says reality is characterized by the three marks of existence: impermanence, anicca; unsatisfactoriness or suffering, dukkha; and non-self, anatta. So each of those are talks for another day. But these are the pointers that reality has some characteristics. These are the three characteristics of existence for us to study, understand through right view, and penetrate through practice, embodied understanding. They both go hand in hand. So Dharma talks like this one might point the way, like signposts along the path. Like, hey, take a look at this. This might be helpful, but the deeper learning is through your own experience and reflection. And like Dharma talks are like, you know, can be thought of also like reading. So they engage the mind. And this is a first step toward wise view. And the next step must be taken through practice. So as you practice today, notice breath by breath, moment by moment, any beliefs, values, or attitudes that arise. Notice judgments. They often point out what your beliefs and values are. For example, maybe you have the thought, I wish the person next to me would stop breathing so loud. Or, why can't I sit still? Everyone else is sitting still. Notice the deepest assumptions behind your judgments. Not only assumptions like, I assume that others should breathe quietly, or I assume I'm a bad meditator. You might notice these assumptions and judgments, but also a deeper one, I assume I'm separate from the person sitting next to me. I'm a separate self. Notice how these judgments form, watching them breath by breath. Or the other one, another one, I believe my thoughts are who I am, that these thoughts are me. So watch the views as they arise, noting any assumptions about self or reality that they point to. But I also encourage us all to find some balance in this practice. Like, there could be a tendency to just jump from judgment to judgment. Like, oh, there's one. All right, now I got to deconstruct this. And you could really wrap your mind, get your mind wrapped around, you know, busy for the whole practice doing that. Or you can be on the search for looking for any view that might lead to suffering. What we're doing here is just noticing all the experiences that we can notice as they arise and pass. Some of them will be around view, but some of them won't. We're seeing the truth of each moment. And it's in the present moment that wise view comes into view. So let's sit together, moving from the Dharma talk and the effort to understand with our minds to meditating, the practice, opening the way for experiential, embodied understanding of reality.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.